More Palestinian civilians are killed in Gaza as the Israeli military keeps pounding the blockaded territory with more air and artillery attacks. One of the deadliest strikes happened in the Nusayr refugee camp in central Gaza, where at least 16 Palestinians were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed two residential buildings. Dozens of others were injured in the attack. Also in central Gaza, an Israeli airstrike in Deir al-Balah killed several people and injured a number of two others. Two Israeli strikes on areas in Gaza City in central Gaza killed at least 15 civilians. Four Palestinians were killed in the Israeli shelling of Gaza City's Al Doraj neighborhood. Fatalities were also reported following Israeli strikes in Jabalia, northern Gaza. Jabalia has been the focal point of Israel's attacks for nearly a month. Israel's genocidal campaign, which began last October, has killed more than 43,200 Palestinians so far, leaving over 101,000 others injured. We earlier talked to our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabeh, who provided us with further details on the latest Israeli attacks across Gaza. Let's take a listen.
Over the past couple of hours, after the Israeli warplanes bombed at least two residential buildings in Al-Nusayr refugee camp, killing at least 16 Palestinian civilians, most of them were women and children as usual, and leaving dozens of the Palestinian injuries. In the meantime, another attack took place in Deir al-Balah city, targeting a residential building as well, killing two Palestinian civilians and leaving multiple Palestinian injuries at the same time. And as you know, over the past couple of hours, another attack took place in a Zawada town when the Israeli fighter drones attacked a gathering of the Palestinian people, killing two Palestinian civilians. So it was a bloody day for the Palestinian people in the central area of Gaza Strip as a result of the ubiquitous and the ongoing Israeli brutal and cruel attacks targeting the residential buildings and the gatherings of the Palestinian people. And as you know, the Israeli artillery shelling was maintained brutally and heavily against the northern part of Al-Nusayr refugee camp. Those areas are still witnessing more cruel and vehement bombardments of the Israeli artillery mobilized in the Nusayr corridor. When it comes to Gaza City, the Israeli occupation forces continue to carry out and conduct more air raids against the residential buildings. The fish one took place in the northern part of Gaza City, particularly Ashanti area, when the Israeli warplanes targeted and pounded another residential building, claiming the lives of five Palestinian civilians, and dozens are still believed missing under the rubble as usual.
Israel's latest attack on Gaza's Gamalad One hospital, which caused injuries and damaged medical supplies, has drawn condemnations from humanitarian organizations. The World Health Organization's chief slammed the attack, saying that it injured hospital staff and damaged life-saving supplies and water tanks. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus stressed that the attack has put patients' lives at grave risk. The UN humanitarian agency OCHA said the regime's attack hit the hospital's third floor, resulting in the loss of supplies delivered just 5 days ago. Doctors Without Borders, for its part, said it was extremely alarmed by the Israeli forces' detention of the hospital's medical staff. It called on the regime to guarantee the safety of all medical staff in Gaza who work under impossible conditions and are facing horrific violence as they try to provide care. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out new operations, striking several Israeli targets inside the occupied territories. The Umbrella Group of Iraqi Resistance Factions said during its latest operations, vital Israeli targets in the south of the occupied lands were targeted twice using drones. The group's drones also struck two other vital targets in the center of the occupied Palestinian territories and also in the occupied Golan Heights. The Islamic Resistance says its operations are in support of the Palestinian and Lebanese people. It stresses that the strikes are also in response to the massacres carried out by the Israeli regime against civilians, including women, children, and the elderly, across the occupied territories. The Iraqi Resistance has vowed to press ahead with its anti-Israel operations with increasing intensity. Iran has summoned Germany's Charge d'Affaires to strongly condemn Berlin's decision to close three Iranian consulates, calling the move unjustified and irrational. Iran's foreign ministry described Germany's decision as a deliberate attempt to deprive Iranian nationals of essential consular services and a violation of their basic rights. The ministry also denounced the German government's disregard for principles of international law and its support for terrorism under the guise of protecting German nationals. The foreign ministry also criticized the decision as a miscalculation and interference in Iran's domestic affairs, holding Germany responsible for its consequences. Germany's decision followed Iran's execution of an Iranian national convicted of involvement in terrorist attacks, which killed a large number of innocent people. Political analyst Mark Dankov joined us earlier to discuss Germany's anti-Iran moves. He says Berlin has a long history of aligning with Tehran's enemies, including the Israeli regime and U.S.-backed terrorist groups. Let's take a listen.
I don't think anyone internationally takes Germany particularly seriously in all of this because, of course, Germany has been reflexively pro-Zionist for virtually any reason under the sun since the end of the Second World War. And in this particular case, Germany is going to follow the same lead on Israel that the United States does, which is not only leading Germany by the nose in terms of all of this, but also the United States has undeniable, almost monolithic influence over the position of all of the EU countries in regard to this whole question of Israel and Iran, attempting to demonize anything at all that Iran does, no matter how justified it is. And at the same time, all of these countries, including Germany, supporting anything that Israel does, no matter how heinous it is,
exactly,
up to and including this current genocide in Gaza and Lebanon that's going on. Germany, like the United States in particular, the other EU countries secondarily, is going to succumb to Israeli pressure on anything up to and including what Germany's policy is going to be on Iran. Clearly, in this particular case, Germany maintains an absolute official silence on the fact that over 42,000 Palestinians are dead in Gaza.
Iran's deputy IRGC chief says Iran will definitely respond to Israel's recent aggression against the country. Speaking to the Lebanese television channel Al-Mayadeen, Brigadier General Ali Fadavi said Iran has responded to each and every act of aggression by the Zionist regime over the past 40 years. The general said Iran can target all the regime's critical sites in a single operation. In his remarks, the Iranian commander also said that the martyrdom of the resistance leaders would only strengthen the resistance axis. He said the regime mistakenly thought it could destroy Hezbollah by assassinating its late leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Meanwhile, Major General Hossein Salami, the head of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, warned of an unimaginable response to Israel. He added that the regime has reached the stage of collapse as it acts blindly and commits any crime. In the U.S., the race for the White House is heating up ahead of November the 5th presidential election. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are currently campaigning in key states. They have delivered passionate speeches and given bold promises for future. Rachel Hamdoun joined us earlier to give us more details on what each candidate has pledged to fulfill if elected. Let's take a listen.
So in the latest updates, we know that it's been not only a very tight race, but a lot of updates have happened in the past 10 days, as we are only days away from November 5th, which happens to be Monday, and that is Election Day. Now, in the latest updates, over 59 million have already voted in the United States by either going in person or by sending in their votes through the mail, and that is again just days away before November 5th, when it is the deadline for voting to happen. As of polls yesterday, it shows that Harris is actually slightly leading ahead of Trump by one percentage point, which does, again, insist that this is being much of a tighter race than most can think, especially in the seven battleground states. So far, Harris is leading in Michigan, in Nevada, and Wisconsin. Meanwhile, Trump is leading in Georgia, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and in Arizona. Now, yesterday, former President Bill Clinton was actually in Michigan, where he was campaigning for Harris. And we know that Michigan does have a large Arab majority community in the area. He actually called Harris, quote, a problem solver.
South Africa's ruling party, the ANC, has commemorated the martyred Hamas and Hezbollah leaders by reflecting on the similarities to the country's own struggles against apartheid. Hassan Seria reports.
South Africa's own experience in confronting a violent oppressor shows that the people are the backbone of any resistance. Veteran anti-apartheid military commander and former intelligence minister Ronnie Castrels says he personally communicated this message to Palestinian resistance leaders in Syria and the Gaza Strip. Commemorating the martyrdom of Hamas resistance movement leaders Ismail Haniyeh and Yahya Sinwar and Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah, Castrels and other figures reflected on the way forward to hold Israel to account.
The people in struggle is your power. The armed struggle reinforces the overall struggle. The underground network assists the resistance. We've seen this. And then number four is international solidarity. Very powerful.
So despite the assassination of senior leaders of the resistance, which was also witnessed during the South African freedom struggle, where exiled activists were assassinated through letter bombs, the resistance will go on.
Martyrdom in itself and the loss of our leaders, it's plays such a pivotal role. So even if you're a person of no faith, but when your leader is killed in a most brutal fashion, assassinated, you actually take courage from that, and in fact, it speeds the downfall of the tyrant.
While South Africa has been commended for charging Israel with genocide at the International Court of Justice, people have urged it to take more decisive actions, such as through sanctions. Those who masterminded South Africa's struggle against apartheid say the government has so far failed to properly address the issue.
When South Africa takes action, the world really takes note. And the moral voice and strength of South Africa.
Despite the political maneuvers on the front lines, the message hasn't changed. Recent weeks have witnessed a surge of intense and deadly anti-Israeli operations, proving that the assassination of top leaders such as Said Hassan Nasrallah, Yahya Sinwar and Ismail Haniyeh will not diminish the strength of the resistance. Rather, these Israeli crimes will only intensify the determination of the resistance to deal even heavier blows on the occupying regime. Hassan Seria, Cape Town.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. During the past year, the Zionist regime has murdered at least 177 journalists in Gaza, 11 in Lebanon, and one in Syria. This is unprecedented in the documented history of war. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "In recent days, the Zionist regime aggression has directly targeted media outlets critical of their invasions of both Gaza and Lebanon. The Zionist regime's regional war has been the deadliest for journalists in recorded history, as reporters have been direct targets of their aggression and even falsely labeled as combatants. In recent days, this aggression has directly targeted media outlets critical of the Zionist regime's invasion of both Gaza and Lebanon. Recently, the Zionist regime bombed an office used by Al-Mayadi News in the Jannah neighborhood of the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Although the media network evacuated this office in advance, the strike resulted in one death and injuring of five others, including a child, and that's according to Lebanese Health Ministry." In November 2023, the Zionist regime airstrikes targeted and killed two Al-Mayadin journalists, correspondent Farah Omar and cameraman Rabi Memari, as they reported on developments in southern Lebanon. The news outlet was started in 2012, primarily with the help of former Al Jazeera Arabic journalists who were dissatisfied with the media outlet's coverage of the Syrian war. Since then, the platform has been repeatedly targeted due to its consistently favorable coverage towards the Palestinian cause, more specifically the regional axis of resistance that opposes the US and Zionist imperialism. Like Al Jazeera, Al-Mayadin has been banned from reporting by the Zionist regime and accused of being affiliated with terrorism. However, Al-Mayadin's ban has been in place longer than that of Al Jazeera, beginning in November of last year. On the same day that Al-Mayadin's office was bombed in Beirut, six Gaza-based Al Jazeera journalists were accused by the Zionist regime of being affiliated with the resistance movement Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, putting a target on their heads. The two most prominent journalists accused of being terrorists by the Zionist regime were Anas Asharif and Hossam Shabat, both based in northern Gaza. The Zionists offered no proof for their outlandish claims, while current members of the Zionist regime government shared the claims against Al Jazeera journalists. So too did members of the Zionist opposition. Notably, former Zionist regime Prime Minister Naftali Bennett accused the six journalists of being terrorists, the same man who had used a random video to claim that PIJ fighters had killed veteran Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghele back in 2022. An Israeli regime troop had killed Shirin Abu Aghele in the Jenin refugee camp with a precise headshot, which was clear from the beginning, yet the Bennett held to the claim that it was actually Palestinians who had shot her. The The video he was referring to was debunked by Israel's top human rights group, B'Tselem, later that day. Despite this, as Prime Minister Naftali Bennett never apologized for lying publicly and refused to prosecute Shirin Abu Aghalé's killer. Recently, the Zionist regime also bombed a press station in the southern Lebanese town of Hasbiya, murdering two Al-Mayadin journalists. Cameraman Ghassan Najjar and broadcast engineer Mohammad Rida, in addition to killing Al-Manar's camera operator Wessam Qasem. Western corporate media, even including The Guardian newspaper, described the attack as killing journalists from Hezbollah-affiliated TV stations. This was despite the fact that journalists from Sky News, TRT, Al Jazeera, Al Jadid, Al Ghahira, and other outlets were all based in the same facility at which vehicles with the word press written on them were parked out the front. During the past year, the child killer regime of Israel has murdered at least 177 journalists in Gaza, 11 in Lebanon, and one in Syria. This is unprecedented in the documented history of war.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to stop sinning in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, an honor to be here at your service, dear friends. We are talking about how to stop sinning in our Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, when we're talking about the Islamic lifestyle, you know, this is a beautiful, pure, blessed lifestyle that leads to prosperity in both this world and the next. And so you would be insane to not want to live the Islamic lifestyle. So when we're talking about the Islamic lifestyle, of course, one of the things that is a part of the Islamic lifestyle is to stop sinning. As we have said in some of our programs, that the very fundamental, two fundamental aspects of the Islamic lifestyle is one is to do that which we must do, and the second one is to not do that what we must not do. Hopefully I said that correctly. So now these are in the Arabic terminology. They are known as wajib, obligatory, and things that are haram, prohibited. And now we are talking about how to not commit sins when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. So, well, the easiest thing that one can do, and well, maybe it's not that easy, but still, one of the simplest things that one can do in order to prevent themselves from committing sins is to have the reverential fear of the Almighty Allah. Now, this is something that is very profound, but if you try to implement it in your lives, and all of us try to implement it in our lives, that is to have the reverential fear. In some places, this is it comes in different Arabic words. You have, you know, khawf, which is fear of a certain kind with a certain definition. Even taqwa is in some places defined as reverential fear. Khashya is also another word which is kind of defined as fear as well. Of course, they have their own intricacies in the Arabic language that the English language does not have. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how to stop committing sins when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. So we said that having the reverential fear of the Almighty Allah is something which is necessary in order for us to be able to stop committing sins. Now, of course, you know, when you fear your parents, you fear their retribution, you fear their disappointment, you fear the punishment that might come about, and you fear their status, you know, you fear that they might be ashamed of you because if you do a certain thing. So there's a lot of similarities with these emotions that we as children have when it comes to our parents and how we as servants and creations of the Almighty Allah should have with the Almighty Allah, right? This is the kind of fear that we're talking about. When you have the fear that if you commit a certain sin, that Allah will be disappointed in you and Allah loves you so incredibly much, how painful would it be to disappoint Allah? Or, for example, the punishment of the Almighty Allah. When you think about the severe punishments for the sins that we commit, then we start to, you know, we don't want to do that. And on the other hand, the benefits that we have, the rewards that we will receive if we don't commit sins, right, is paradise and a whole bunch of other things. And finally, it is the attainment of the love of the Almighty Allah, our ultimate creator and sustainer. And so all of these things combined and the fear of the Almighty Allah, it helps us to not commit sins in our Islamic lifestyle. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Gaza health officials warn nearly 200 critically wounded patients at Kamal Adwan Hospital are at risk of imminent death. Kamal Adwan is one of the three hospitals in northern Gaza heavily affected by the intense Israeli regime siege and attacks since the Zionist regime launched a new offensive in the area on October 5th. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, Northern Gaza's health system is now completely out of service following an Israeli regime invasion of the last operational hospital in the area, a health official has said. According to Marwan Al-Hems, the director of field hospitals at the Palestinian Health Ministry, around 200 critically wounded patients at the Kamal Adwan Hospital are at risk of imminent death after an invasion by Israeli regime forces that destroyed medical supplies and kidnapped staff. He told Al Jazeera during a live interview recently, "If the world does not intervene to stop this crime and the genocide in Gaza, the certain fate of these patients is death. Israeli troops destroyed all drug inventories at the hospital yesterday, claiming they were looking for militants. Now, all drug stocks have been deliberately damaged to prevent doctors from saving the lives of the wounded." He added, "The smell of death is everywhere, at the hospital and its vicinity." The Zionist regime forces stormed Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia recently. The assault began with airstrikes targeting the hospital and its courtyards, including the medical oxygen generator. According to Dr. Munil Arbersh, Director General of the Palestinian Health Ministry, Bursh said the bombing of the oxygen supply caused the death of children in the hospital and wounded medical staff. "Instead of receiving aid, we receive tanks, which are shelling the hospital building," said Dr. Hussam Abu Safiye, the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital, in a video published on his social media shortly after the attack. Health officials said Abu Safiye's son had died as a result of the Zionist regime invasion on the hospital. Social media users shared footage from Ibrahim Abu Safiye's funeral, with his father leading prayers and participating in the burial ceremony. A few hours after the airstrikes, the Zionist regime troops raided the hospital and called on all patients, including those in intensive care, to gather in the courtyard. They assaulted everyone inside, the director of nursing at a hospital told Al Arabi TV. The Palestinian Health Ministry in a statement said hundreds of patients, medical staff and some displaced people from homes near the hospital who had sought shelter there from the continuous shelling have been detained. No food, medicines and medical supplies necessary to save the lives of the wounded and patients in the hospital have been supplied or provided. According to Hems, after the Zionist regime troops withdrew from the hospital, quadcopters began firing at it, injuring more people inside. The Director General of the World Health Organization, WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, denounced the attack on Kamal Adwan Hospital as deeply disturbing. He said the WHO had lost touch with its personnel there. He wrote on X, "Kamal Adwan Hospital has been overflowing with close to 200 patients, a constant stream of horrific trauma cases. It is also full of hundreds of people seeking shelter." He added, "We call for an immediate ceasefire, the protection of hospitals, patients, health professionals, and humanitarians." Kamal Adwan is one of the three hospitals in northern Gaza heavily affected by the intense Israeli regime siege and attacks since the Zionist regime launched a new offensive in the area on October 5th. The two other hospitals, the Indonesian Hospital and Al-Auda Hospital, ceased operations in recent days due to Israeli regime attacks and severe shortages of food, medicine and fuel. Until the Zionist raid, Kamal Adwan Hospital had been operating at minimal capacity, providing life-saving care to newborn infants in neonatal intensive care units and other patients in ICUs. Rights groups have condemned the Zionist regime's operation in northern Gaza as part of a plan to ethnically cleanse the area of Palestinians. A UN inquiry earlier this month accused the Zionist regime of committing war crimes and the crime against humanity of extermination in Gaza through its attacks on the healthcare system.
Sorb International Media Festival.
Part 3.
To become a journalist, you must have a passion to bring forth the truth. You must carry out vast investigations and do research non-stop almost every day. Today I'll be talking to a journalist who, through his fact-finding mission, has become an expert on Islamic jihadi groups. One of his quotes is this: "During my relentless pursuit of the truth, I've discovered that it has many faces, and each one of us will only believe his own definition of what truth is." This is SOAP, and I'm your host, Hassan Tavakol.
Radwan Mortada was born in Libya in 1984 and moved to Lebanon in 1993. In 2007, he started his professional career as a journalist at Al Akhbar newspaper. Since then, he's worked as a journalist, documentary filmmaker, researcher, writer, executive producer, and assignment producer. In 2014, he founded Blue House Film, a production company based in Beirut, Lebanon.
Radwan Mortaza, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Speaking about documentaries, 42 documentaries, how do you find the time to make these? You know, how old are you to begin with?
40.
40, you know, 42 documentaries, you know, if you want to divide them into, you know, calculate some things, that would be, you know, when did you start making documentaries? When was the very first time you started making documentaries? What age?
I have begun making films since 2008, but I founded a production company in 2013. At the beginning, given that I was in contact with jihadists, wanted people, and drug dealers, I was a field producer for most of foreign journalists who arrived in Lebanon. I worked on myself and learned. I made two films in Syria where I was the cameraman, the director, and the journalist at the same time, as I didn't want to endanger someone's life, and decided to risk my life alone and didn't accompany anyone. I made two films, one of them named Yabrud Battle and the other one on Qalamun Mountains, where I filmed the extremist groups that were striking Lebanon and sending car bombs to Lebanon. Subsequently, some documentaries can take several years. I'm currently working on one of that nature because it covers different aspects. Other documentaries can be made in 2 or 3 months. When films take more time, it's usually due to the need to obtain permits for interviews or because of the lengthy process of obtaining necessary documents. Making documentaries is like writing articles. Practicing makes them easier. It might take several days to write an article, but with practice, you can write an article in 2 hours. Given my experience in making documentaries, I know how long each phrase of it takes, including editing. Even when I conduct an interview, I know what I want, so I rarely get surprised by the answers of the interviewee. I usually know the answers that they will say and know which part of it I'll use in my film. The process of making a documentary or a movie is enjoyable. It's a creation of something that didn't exist. It allows you to present your views. Films are like historical documents. They are familiar to books. This is how the Syrian Revolution grew its beard, was my first book. But the number of readers is less than the number of viewers, as people prefer the easiest thing. I love making documentaries as they combine writing and filming. there is a better thing, which is drama, as you reach a wider audience. All the journalists, the directors and producers wanted to reach the largest possible number of people.
Yes, that's a very important point that many people and many journalists say, and many artists, in fact, say that, you know, it's the art of communication, communicating with people and sending them their, sending messages and telling different stories.
Exactly.
Most of your work, your documentary work, is literally all of it is basically political. Have you ever, found interest in, you know, entering the field of non-political documentaries or cinematic stuff?
Political documentaries are my passion as they deliver a message. The problem of those films is that they are good just for a specific time and they can only be watched later by those who are searching the archive. Unlike cultural and social documentaries, such as those on music that I previously mentioned, they can be good for any time and place. Some films like drama persist and can be watched at any time. Hollywood is spending billions of dollars on making movies because they promote their lifestyle and deliver specific messages and try to show that the U.S. can control the planet. Even when Israelis decided to begin producing, they made a number of series, including Tehran. When someone watches it, they will wonder who produced it and how it became famous, given that it's a mess. Cinema and media is a weapon. There are not too many people interested in politics. For example, the new generation is not interested in politics, so you have to make them familiar with it using alternative methods. Apart from newspapers, news bulletins, and political talk shows, you can use social media platforms and short videos that are affordable to form their mindset. Movies and series are also helpful as the new generation can be influenced by their protagonists. Consequently, you can direct him to what you believe is the right path.
What would your advice be to aspiring filmmakers and journalists who want to, you know, follow in your footsteps, make documentaries and, you know, get into the work you do? What would your advice be to them?
I'm not sure if I'm in a position to give advice, but I think the most important thing is insistence. Working in this field is tiring as it affects your personal life. Your entire life revolves around work, which consumes a significant amount of time. Searching for new ideas and trying to reveal truth require time. As I enjoy my work, time passes without me noticing. If you're not passionate about this job and if you lack resoluteness, you won't be able to persist in doing it. And if you manage to persist in doing it without passion, you'll be an employee doing your routine job. I didn't want to be an employee and to abide by specific working hours. So I established my own company to take control of my time. But actually, it's my job that's taking control of my time. So you have to do this job with passion and determination and view it as a hobby that makes money and not as a job. Because if you considered that as a job, you wouldn't succeed.
Yes, the life of a journalist and a filmmaker together is very difficult, as you said. One has not, doesn't have a life.
Crazy, you know? People. And
yeah, but so how do you balance that, you know, work and your personal life? How do you balance it?
I just got married about a year ago, and my first child was born just 40 days ago. So work has affected my personal life. I try to create a balance between them, but I have failed to do so. Still, I hope to make that balance, which is so hard. People who succeed in both of their personal life and professional life deserve applause. I hope I'll make that someday.
And so how will that new life that you've, you know, brought into your own life, okay, a wife, a child, how would that affect your future cinematography?
Now I've become more selective. In the past, I worked on various topics, but now the works that I choose to make should be iconic because I dedicate my time to them at the expense of my daughter, wife, and family. So these works should have a message and benefit the people. After all, none of us will last forever, so I hope my work will speak for me.
Would you like your daughter to follow in your footsteps? To be a journalist or a film director or something?
I would like my daughter to become a film director because of the risks associated with being a journalist. faced many threats, and there have been repeated attempts to hack my cell phone by various parties, even by governments. I was the first one in Lebanon to be targeted by a company cooperating with Israel that hacks the journalists' cell phones. I was based in the UAE. Journalists are always threatened by whoever you write an article about them. Consequently, journalists have to be careful when they are moving. I'm calm and know how to handle those issues and also have an experience. But I think this profession can be so dangerous and stressful for a girl. Therefore, I won't encourage my daughter to become a journalist, but I will encourage her to become a film director.
At the end of every show of ours, we request our guest to look into the camera opposite them and speak their mind, you know, to whomever they want to address, you know, to the world, to whoever they have in mind. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, in this episode, we spoke a lot about me, but amidst our conversation, I emphasized that resistance fighters are being martyred for the sake of a just cause that they embrace. They are defending me and my family in Lebanon. At the same time, our people in Palestine are brutally killed amid the silence of the world. This scene highlights that we are at a crossroad that shows who supports the truth and who supports the oppressor. Since October 7, a new chapter of history has been written. We shouldn't forget that. We also should keep praying for the resistance fighters. Moreover, we have to continue to wield our words, weapons, and every possible means to build a better future for us and for our region, to be able to liberate our countries and be independent from global arrogance, and to build countries full of justice, safety, and stability. This speech may be dismissed by some people as mere slogans after they had been repeated by officials, but those words should be transformed into tangible actions. We can build a better society.
And we thank our guest, Radwan Murtada from Lebanon, for taking part in this program. Until another program, from me, Hassan Tavakoli, and the rest of the team here, it's goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer your queries and questions and we discuss very important topics on Islamic upbringing of your children. Our answers are rooted in the Holy Book of Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today we have had the pleasure to be with Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum, sister.
A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much.
So, dear listeners, Brother Liaqat is really interested in conducting research in the fields of Islamic history, psychology, and philosophy. And currently, he's pursuing a master's degree in Islamic psychology at Jamaat al-Mustafa Institute of Islamic and Social Sciences. Well, Brother Liaqat, again, a very warm welcome.
Thank you so much, sister.
So, as we delve into the topic of Islamic upbringing, I request you to provide us with examples from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that specifically relate to upbringing and guidance of adolescents.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Definitely, inshallah, it would be my pleasure to bring to you many examples from the Holy Quran as well as from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Firstly, I would like to bring the story of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salatu wassalam from the Holy Quran, where the Quran reminds us how he was exposed, that is Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam, as you can see, how he was exposed to the most difficult test and the most dangerous historical event of his time during the sensitive period of puberty, that is his early youth, that right. is his teenage, yeah? So, and also we can see with a strong will and firm faith, Hazrat Yusuf alayhi salatu wasalam came out of this divine test proudly and took a place at the top of honor and chastity. And of course, his character remained forever as a role model and a perfect example for teenagers.
Right.
Yeah. So this is a big lesson for the teenagers. And of course, those who strive hard and battle with their own soul.
It's very hard. Like, you know, sometimes when we talk about patience, one concept that is really common in our societies is that patience is only in the time of tragedy and trouble. But here, Prophet Yusuf teaches us that patience is also in the times of sins. Like when you have all the grounds ready to commit a sin and then you stop. Yourself.
Exactly. Exactly. So we patience. Have a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam as well. So patience when calamities befall upon a person and also patience against a sin. So this type of patience has a very huge reward. Exactly.
Right.
When compared to calamities. I'm not comparing though, but from the narrations we find that if a person, if he's given the opportunity or she is given an opportunity to commit a sin, but if the person doesn't go ahead, if the teen or even a normal person like big adults as well, if they don't go ahead and commit the sin, there are numerous rewards which are like uncountable.
Yeah,
we can
they're
say.
Actually practicing sabr, patience.
Exactly, exactly. Right. So the reward of patience is something which a person will definitely see in grave. Like there will be few enlightened personalities entering the grave. And when everyone failed to protect this person, there will be a person standing at the corner. This person, who is a dead soul, of course, like he's a living soul, but the dead person, the soul is going to ask the person standing at the corner, who are you? And the person standing over there with enlightened form, he's going to say, I am the patience which you used to have when you were alive.
MashaAllah. We'll continue our discussion. Let's take a short break here. We'll be back in a while.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Brother Liaquat, and we have been discussing something very, very interesting. We're discussing examples from the lives of prophets and also Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam while it comes to the Islamic upbringing. So, Brother Liaquat, you told us about the story of Prophet Yusuf, and you said how he practiced patience when he was having all the grounds to go ahead with the sin. So what else?
So we can also see Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam saying in this regard, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this is for the parents, we can say, may God have mercy on the servant who helps his child in his goodness and happiness. Do him favors and be friendly with him and educate him. So I don't want to bring the Arabic quote, like a narration right, over right. here because of the time limit we have. So Rasulullah is emphasizing upon how a person should treat his child or a teenager, right. of course. When he says a child, of course, it goes back to his childhood, his teenagehood and everything. Yeah.
Right.
So this is like a general aspect hadith, what we can see over here. So in reality, Rasulullah is praying to that person, like, may Allah have mercy on the servant.
Right.
So this is a prayer of Rasulullah. And we can see that, like, the prayer of Rasulullah is never rejected. Yeah.
Right.
So may Allah have mercy on the servant who helps his child in goodness, in the teachings of good manners. Yeah.
Right.
And also in happiness. So it's very important in the lifestyle of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. We see like they make their children happy, like the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalatu wasalam.
Yeah.
And they try their level best to keep their children happy.
Right.
And of course, like through halal means, indeed, of course, this is one thing which we can learn. And number two is training them with goodness,
right.
like to get good traits.
Right.
And then Rasulullah tells something and do upon him favors, like upon your child.
Right.
And be friendly with him. This is something very important. Like in today's world, we see the parents having a different outlook. Oh, you know what? I'm elder to you, so you have to listen everything to me.
Gap.
Exactly. Yeah. I think there's a kind of lack between parenthood.
His friendshipness is not
exactly.
There.
Exactly. And also educate him. So it's not just being friendly with him, but also educating the teenager is extremely important. With this, a person can get the dua of Rasulullah, like basically having the mercies of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala
right.
By applying this in his life or her life, inshallah.
So it's also actually a responsibility of parents to do goodness to a child, to make him happy, to do him favors, like all parents do that. But when they keep this kind of hadith in their mind and then they feel like they're acting on the hadith and also carrying out their responsibilities, it becomes like more mustahab act. Otherwise, it's just a responsibility. But when they act on the hadith, it's like more responsibility. And they have to keep this generation gap aside and be more friendly with them so that their children also rely more on them.
Indeed.
We'll discuss more with you, brother, Inshallah. After a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, Allah will write a reward for he who kisses his child, and Allah will bring happiness on Judgment Day to he who makes his child happy.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and Brother Liaquat is with us. We are discussing the examples from the lives of prophets and Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam in upbringing the children. Yes, Brother Liaquat.
So, and also another example, what we see from the Holy Quran is when Hazrat Luqman al-Hakim used to advise his son, he addresses him with a beautiful address, like he would call him Ya Bunayya, you
okay.
see? And also we see the same with regards to Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. When he writes a letter to Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wasalam, he addresses him by saying Ya Bunayya 10 times, which is not a small thing. Ya Bunayya is like, oh, my dear son. If you translate it, my dear son, my dear.